Good evening, and welcome to What the World Needs Now, with host Ken Johnston. Stay tuned as Ken talks with authors, journalists, and others regarding topics important to us as Catholics in a world that's in desperate need of God's love. Love that comforts
from heaven above. And welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your prayerful and financial support that's kept us on the air for over 40 years now. And one of the ways you can keep us on the air is by supporting our upcoming golf outing that's going to take place on Monday, October the 14th. We just have a save the date out on our website now. But once we have the details on registration and sponsorship opportunities, we will be sure to let you know. A couple of retreat opportunities that are coming up this summer. Kathleen McCarthy, our president, will be out at the Malvern Retreat House not this coming weekend, but the following, June 21st to the 23rd, for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia Catholic Charismatic Retreat. Again, that'll take place June 21st to June 23rd. My men's retreat that I make every year out at Malvern, the Edward J. Friel Senior Memorial Group, will be going to Malvern August 16th to the 18th. Our retreat director this year is an author that I had on the radio March of last year, Father Bryce Lundgren, the cowboy priest. He'll be coming in from Cheyenne, Wyoming, in order to direct that retreat. And in September, we have the second annual Matt Talbot Women's Retreat. It'll take place September 13th to the 15th. For those three retreats and any others out at Malvern, you can register online at malvernretreat.com. That's malvernretreat.com. Or give the retreat house a call at 610-644-0400. Guest in this hour today is Connie Marshner. And Connie fell in love with Ireland when she was in middle school, and with the Eastern Church when she found Holy Transfiguration Melkite Greek Catholic Church in McLean, Virginia, a few years later. She heard echoes of Eastern hymnody in some late antique Irish prayers and poetry, and the pursuit of a master's degree in Gaelic literature at the University College Cork gave her the opportunity to do in-depth research on the topic. Monastery and High Cross, the book we're going to talk about, is drawn from her 2022 dissertation. She is a teacher of Gaelic. She is the chair of the Saints and Scholars Foundation, which supports a new model of faithful Catholics, of Catholic education, for modern secular Ireland. And the website is www.saintsandscholars.us. And she lives in Front Royal, Virginia. Welcome to the show, Connie. It's great to have you with us.
Oh, it's grand to be here. Thank you.
And I picked up the book over the weekend and started reading it. And I mentioned to you on the, we had just a minute together before we got started here, I mentioned the end of the last show to our Irish listeners to, you know, if you're going to stick around in this hour, you better have an open mind because you're going to have to unlearn some of the things that may have been ingrained in you, or at least you know, see a slight twist to it. So, you know, what was it that, you know, it mentions in your bio, you know, how you kind of fell in love with the, both the Eastern Church and the Irish, and now bring them both together in this book.
Yes, and I'm so lucky that I've been able to come back and work on something that meant so much to me. I mean, I fell in love with Ireland really in sixth grade, I guess, when I read The Story of the Irish Race by Seamus McManus. But my interest had been piqued, of course, by my mother, because I remember in second grade being told to eat my potatoes because I had to think of the starving Irish.
Yeah.
You know, so naturally, that probably a lot of people felt that too. But that planted the seeds. But then, you know, I was living through the turmoil of post-Vatican II church, and things were getting weird. And then I discovered the Eastern Rite, the Melkite Church. I was working on Capitol Hill in Washington, and outside of Washington is Holy Transfiguration Melkite Greek Catholic Church, which is just the most fantastic Eastern tradition church, and it is so true to its Eastern roots, and yet so very, very Catholic. And of course, it's in union with Rome, and so that became my home. And the liturgy, every sentence in the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom is taken from Scripture, and you can get editions that have footnotes for where every line comes from. So, and then there are so many other services. Praises to the Blessed Mother during Lent, and Vespers, and Compline, and all those sorts of things, which our parish does every night of the week during Lent. So I had heard so much of this. And then when the fad came about in the 1990s, I guess, there was a little mini fad of rediscovering Celtic spirituality. And there was a lot of New Age type stuff involved with that. But there was also some very good reprints became available of ancient Irish prayers and hymns. And I read some of them, and it just sounded like an echo of the East. It just sounded familiar. And I put that, on my shelf of, isn't that an interesting thing? And then when COVID came along and I learned about this online master's degree in Gaelic literature at Cork, I said, wow, okay. So I spent 2 years just immersing myself in ancient Ireland, late antique Ireland particularly. And that was the topic I chose for my dissertation, to track down all of these references, because there had always been, in the academic and scholarly writings, there had always been little references going back to the 17th century that, golly, this seems very Greek, or this doesn't look like Roman stuff. But nobody had ever pulled together all the footnotes, the art, the architecture, the archaeology, the literature, etc. So that was what I did, and that's what Monastery and High Cross is. It's a comprehensive review of all the available information about the Eastern influences in early Irish Christianity. And it's written in a very, it's got tons of footnotes, 300 some footnotes, but it's written in a very approachable style. So it's not an academic book. It's for anybody to read and enjoy.
No, I agree. I picked it up, and I'm not the most scholarly of people, and I was able to get through what I tried to get through in preparing for the show. I've been blessed to go to Ireland twice. I went with my father back in the late 90s because his mother and father both came from Ireland, one from Donegal and the other from Derry. And when we were in Donegal, we went up to the Gaeltacht, where they still speak Irish. At least they did in the late 90s. I don't know if they still do today.
Oh, no, the language is coming back.
Yeah.
The language is coming back.
Yeah. And you mentioned the 90s, and I remember more than a handful of people that I knew that were moving back to Ireland. And, there was that draw of a bunch of people were getting their Irish passports. That we're second generation here, and we're still able to, and the fad was definitely there. But it was in 2015 I went over, and it was more to learn about hopefully a future Irish saint in Venerable Matt Talbot. And going through your book and I mentioned it to you briefly, but when we went down to Glendalough, which is where St. Kevin's Monastery was. And saw the beehive hut that he lived in, and remember Father Brian Lawless telling us the story about how he would pray with his arms outstretched, and sometimes it was long enough for a bird to build a nest in his hand, and I didn't realize it until your book that you thought maybe it was something that was Irish or Celtic. But you were able to inform me otherwise, which I was pleasantly surprised to read.
Right, right. That's called, in Ireland, they call it the cross-spiegel position, where you stand and recite the 150 psalms in their entirety with your arms outstretched in the position of the cross. And that people for a long time said, boy, those Irish were really weird. But no, that came from Egypt. That was part of the Egyptian monastic tradition. So that's one of the little tidbits of information that's evidence of that early, early influence in Ireland. There's a well, there are scabs, hundreds of holy wells in Ireland, but there's one in Uggabalogue, County Cork, that is called St. Olan's Well. And it's just always been there forever, and everybody knows about it. But there's a stone beside it that has carving in the Ogham script. Now, that went out of use at the end of the 4th century, for the most part. But eventually people figured out how to translate it. And what that stone says is, pray for St. Olan the Egyptian. So, and that's before the end of the 4th century. So there was at least a holy man from Egypt who was there seeking a desert, and I'm sure it was very remote, and he wanted to be very remote, but people knew he was a holy man. And that's what monks were in those early, early days of the church. There were other evidence of that, like, in architecture and in art, St. Brigid's Monastery in Kildare was decorated. One of the contemporaries, you know, who wrote about it at the time, her biographer actually, describes how in her chapel there was a partition wall between the altar and the people that was covered with paintings of saints and scripture. Well, pardon me, but isn't that what you call an iconostasis? And isn't that what you find in every Eastern church today? Again, a little evidence of the Eastern traditions. What we know about the practices in those early Irish monasteries, they did prostrations. Not genuflections, but prostrations. Prostrations are, you know, forehead to floor. And that was routine practice. On the way to receive communion, you would do prostrations. What we have of altar equipment that has survived and been dug out of places where it was lost for centuries really, really, really makes it clear that baptisms were by immersion. And Holy Eucharist was given with a spoon. Again, the Eastern tradition. And so, you know, there was lots of traffic between Ireland and the East. Always was. There never wasn't. But it all got forgotten. You know, it all got forgotten because, you know, Ireland got forgotten after about the 11th century. When the Normans invaded Ireland. Fortunately, Ireland had never been invaded by Rome. And that made all the difference. Because that meant that Ireland, when Rome left, when Rome left Britain in 410, and it had been very less and less of a presence there before. Otherwise, St. Patrick would not have been able to be kidnapped because they would have been protecting the coast. But anyhow, so Rome left. Christianity pretty much disappeared in Britain. But Ireland had received the faith from very close to the original sources and was kind of like a locked in time. It became like a time capsule. The church in Ireland communication wasn't what it is today. There was very little communication. Rome was terribly preoccupied with survival and coping with the Vandals and the Huns and all the rest of it and trying to bring order to the rest of continental Europe. So Gaelic culture was able to develop on its own based upon this very, very sound foundation from the fathers. And the Egyptian tradition was ancient. Egyptians had been, during the time of persecutions of the faith, Egyptians had been fleeing into caves. And then when there was all that theological upheaval in Alexandria at the time of the Council of Nicaea and all of that, which went on for centuries, it became very difficult to have peace and quiet in Alexandria. So it's it makes total sense. It's very plausible that monks who just wanted to get away from the world, wanted peace and quiet, would just get on a boat and go west. And that's what the early monasteries in Ireland believed about themselves, which is terribly important. The Antiphonary of Bangor, which is one of the few documents that has survived the Vikings and the Normans and the Cromwellians, etc., one of the few documents from the early church that has survived, it has a passage in there where it talks about itself, you know, the monastery talking about itself. And it calls itself the house full of delight, built on the rock, super Petrum Constructa, which, of course, could be Peter, and indeed true vine transplanted from Egypt. So monasteries are the most conservative place in the world. They don't change from generation to generation, at least until our time. Traditions were handed on. So this monastery in the 6th century claimed its ancestry to be in Egypt. They wouldn't make that up.
No.
Why would they make that up? And, you know, there's a litany that was written in about the 7th century, the Litany of the Cayley Dei, which has a line in there, to pray for 7 Egyptian monks buried in Desert Ili. Now, today, nobody knows where Desert Ili is, but there are hundreds of places in Ireland with the prefix desert, which is the Irish word for desert, and those would have been places where people went to get solitary peace and quiet. And, you know, why would the litany call them Egyptian monks? I mean, they're not going to be fantasizing stuff like that. There's, you know, there's definitely evidence there of a tradition. And then the prayers, the 350s, the Irish call it, the 150 psalms that had to be said every day. And that was a monastic tradition straight from Egypt.
Yeah, when you read the book and listen to you, there's various podcasts that are out there that where you've appeared before and go through some of this stuff. And what was enlightening to me as a Latin Rite Catholic is we think that the church, you know, started in Rome. Like, there was no Catholic Church before Paul went to Rome and established the church there. And in reality, the church was in existence for 3 centuries before the Roman church was really established. So in that light, it makes perfect sense. And the Irish church then has its roots not to Patrick. Certainly Patrick played a significant role in the eventual conversion of Ireland, but the church itself had already been established and goes directly back to the apostles, I think.
Well, I don't think we can say the church had been established in Ireland, because I don't know that the monks, there's no evidence that the monks who would have come in those early, early days would have done much evangelizing.
Oh, okay.
They came and they set up their little seven, like even, as you know, Glendalough, the 7 cells there and the beehive huts on Skellig Michael and so forth. They had their monasteries, but I don't know that there isn't evidence, let's just put it that way, that they were converting people. That really was Patrick's job.
Right.
He really did that. But you're absolutely right, and it's a great point to make that, I mean, most people don't know that before the year 753, there were 11 Greeks and 6 Syrians who sat on the throne of Peter. I mean, Rome was an Eastern church at the crossroads of East and West, you might say. But the liturgy of the East is the most ancient liturgy. And lots of that came into the liturgy in Rome over the course of time, and then it got changed over the course of time. But in those early days, it would have come straight to Ireland, and that would be what was there by the 4th and 5th century. However, it also needs to be said, too, that Rome, as soon as Rome was getting organized and getting put together as a management proposition, Pope Celestine in the year 431 sent a bishop named Palladius to Ireland. The record of that is in Prosper of Aquitaine's Chronicle, where he says that Palladius was sent to the Irish who believed in Christ. So Rome had found out that there were Irish people living in Ireland who believed in Christ, and so he sent a bishop to them. Now, the bishop's mission was not terribly successful. Patrick was successful. Probably because of his history. Remember, he was the lad who didn't want to study, didn't care about the church, was a poor student. His father was a deacon. His grandfather was a priest. Somewhere in the west of England, one fine day, he got kidnapped by a bunch of Irish slave traders who were doing a raid and got taken back to Ireland. Now, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people to whom that happened. So some of those would have been some of the Christians in Ireland, too. But Patrick was then cast for 7 years on a hillside tending sheep out in the cold. It would have been pretty miserable. And that's when he started praying. I mean, he writes that he prayed 100 times a day and 100 times a night, and the Spirit of God was filling him. So that was his conversion when he was on that hillside. But he was there for 7 years. And so he learned the language, and he learned the culture. And then when he escaped, we don't know exactly what happened after he escaped Ireland, because there's dark years where we don't know what happened. But he then hears in his sleep, just like St. Joseph, a call to come back to Ireland, and he comes back to Ireland. And then he is able to bring conversion on a larger scale, because he knows the language, and he knows how to handle the people and how to, you know, make peace with the kings. There were about 150 kings in Ireland. You know, Ireland's a small place, so to have 150 kings, you got to believe that their kingship was over a small area, a family grouping, but it was the basis of his organization.
Very good. I want to remind our listeners that our guest today is Connie Marshner. The book that we're talking about is Monastery and High Cross, The Forgotten Eastern Roots of Irish Christianity. And definitely an enlightening book. And in the sections that I was able to get to this week, I learned a lot. And being of Irish descent, it was enlightening to see. And it doesn't necessarily erase what we may have been taught by our parents or grandparents, but it does provide a lot of the background as to what happened before St. Patrick made his way back to Ireland, as Connie was just talking about. So the book's published by Sophia Institute. You can pick it up on Sophia's website, sophiainstitutepress.com. And locally here in the Philadelphia market, check out the St. Jude shop. If they don't have it in stock, they can get it for you very quickly. And I recommend those two sources before you go to some of the other booksellers. Two of the things that I picked up on was devotions. And they're devotions that I have, Eucharistic devotion and Marian devotion. And I was surprised to read that really in the Latin Church, the Roman Church, that there wasn't much Marian devotion, that it existed before the church took root in Rome and was in Ireland, but never in the mainland of Europe.
Right. It was started in the East, at the very, very beginning, in the lands where Mary would have walked. there are spots in Palestine where the tradition was that she walked there, you know, and those were always considered holy spots. And so there was devotion to her in the East, but it didn't make it across into into continental Europe for centuries, except in Ireland. And it really flowered in Ireland. The devotion to the Mother of God was very strong in Ireland. I mean, scholars say that prior to the 10th century, there was simply no devotional literature in praise of the Virgin Mary anywhere in Europe, in the vernacular. There just simply wasn't, except in Ireland. But there was abundant Marian devotion in hymns in Ireland by the 7th century. And that was the first Marian prayer that we know of had been composed in Egypt in the 3rd century. So there again, we have a very strong evidence of connection there.
It's pretty interesting. We're going to take a break here in a minute. And so I don't want to get into the Eucharistic devotion. We'll save that until we come back.
Oh, confession, too. We've got to talk about confession.
Absolutely. No, absolutely, because we were just talking about that in the previous hour. We talk about the saints in the liturgical calendar. And on Sunday in the Latin Rite, we celebrated St. Ephrem, who, of course, is the only Syriac doctor of the Western Church. And, it seemed odd that they made a point of mentioning that he was baptized relatively young. And as we know, a lot of people would wait until later in life because you could only make one confession. And so the idea of frequent and private confession, I think, comes out in your book. So we'll certainly talk about that. Again, our guest is Connie Marshner. The book we're talking about is Monastery and High Cross, The Forgotten Eastern Roots of Irish Christianity. We're just going to take a short break. More to come when we come back. Don't go away.
Hello, Father Glacy here, and I owe a great debt of gratitude to the In His Sign Radio ministry. It was this radio ministry that I listened to when I was going from being a lukewarm Catholic to an engaged Catholic, and this ministry really majorly affected the Catholic that I am today. Kathleen McCarthy in particular has an uncanny ability to speak to the heart, and when she speaks to the heart, she speaks with God's love, with His grace, and with His mercy. I can honestly say that I am a better Catholic, a better man of God, and have experienced the healing and joy of the gospel because of the great ministry of Kathleen McCarthy. And so I encourage others to listen to her so that they can experience the beautiful work that God does through her beautiful words.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. And again, I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners and thank you for all that you do for us here at InHisSign, both your financial and prayerful support that keeps us on the air and allows us to bring you shows like today's. Again, our guest is Connie Marshner, and the book we're talking about is Monastery and High Cross, The Forgotten Eastern Roots of Irish Christianity. If you missed any part of the first segment, I'll be posting the recording on our website either later tonight or early tomorrow morning, and you'll be able to catch it, especially for my Irish brethren. There's quite a bit you can learn about the old sod from Connie and her book. So before we went to the break, we had mentioned that Marian devotion had found its way to Ireland, even though it had managed to skip mainland Europe from the time that the Roman Church was founded. And the other thing that I noted was the Eucharistic devotion. And, you know, sometimes we live here in the 21st century and we just think that the people 20 centuries ago were doing the exact same thing that we're doing today. And in some cases, that may be. But there's, you know, obviously things that we do today that we didn't do back then. And I hadn't thought about it, you know, in the reservation of the consecrated hosts in a tabernacle. I think most of us just take it for granted that that was always done, that, you know, they would distribute communion. And if there happened to be any that wasn't consumed, that, you know, they would set it aside somewhere. And I think your book makes it pretty clear that that wasn't the case, right?
Right, right. I mean, there's no trace of the reservation of the Blessed Sacrament on the altar in the West until after the 9th century, except in regions influenced by the Celtic and Anglo-Saxon missionaries. And the devotion to the reality of the Eucharist is just staggering, especially by today's standards. They would bow, I mean, they would prostrate themselves on the ground three times before they even dared to approach for Eucharist. And the priest was warned during the moment of transubstantiation. They didn't call it that. They didn't know that word yet. But at the moment of the consecration, the manuals, the antiphonaries for the priest say, you know, this is the moment of great peril. They call it the perilous moment. Why? Because they knew that this was the body of Christ coming into existence in their hands. You had to have deep respect for that, and so much love for it. There was a custom that grew up in Ireland of the chrismal, and the chrismal is like a little glass jar with a cork in the top that would have handles blown into the side, so you could carry it around your neck. And in that would be a piece of the Eucharist, or maybe a drop of the Eucharist. I don't know which, would depend. But people carried that around with them. Now, you can understand why a priest would carry that in case he ran into somebody who needed, you know, who was dying and got gored by an ox or something and needed immediately to have the last rites. But it was more than just priests who carried it. Now, today, that, of course, would not be would not be considered proper.
Right.
But it's evidence of the awe and the devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. And that was definitely a distinctly Irish tradition. So was confession. I mean, it's really not—it's not an exaggeration to say that the practice of private confession is a legacy of Irish monasteries to the universal church. Because—and again, we don't want to impose 20th century standards on, you know, 6th century issues, but for the first 1,000 years of the church, there was no sacrament of reconciliation. You know, there was public confession, during the celebration of the liturgy in the very, very early days, but then that kind of died away. And then there was only public confession for public sins, like offering incense to the gods or adultery or something like that. But that would last you, the penance might last you for the rest of your life. But within the small group of the monastic communities in Ireland, a different model began to emerge. And again, it came from Egypt. And St. John Cassian, who is considered the father of monasticism, and who was only two leaders away from the Irish monastic tradition, and we can talk about that later. But he realized that he organized sins into certain vices and certain antithetical virtues, and each sin was viewed as an illness. And the spiritual father in the monastery had the obligation to search out and apply the correct medicine for that fault. And so Irish abbots, one named Cumian, C-U-M-M-I-A-N, was particularly famous, wrote a penitential listing all the sins and the penances for each one. And that caught on and was used throughout Europe, the tradition of penitentials. But it also, the penances were severe in those monastic penitentials. But Finian, another abbot, realized that saying 150 psalms as a penance was not something a farmer could do, you know, when the cows had to be milked. So, and yet, you know, the goal was that all Christians should be able to move beyond their sin and their guilt. And to do that, they needed a spiritual guide. Now, in the desert, in Egypt, there had been older monks who would guide younger monks. In the Irish monasteries, that became the tradition called the Anam Cara, which is the soul friend. Anam means soul, and Cara means friend. And later, it evolved into the, you know, the pater confessus, the priest who would hear your confession. But this was a guide for everybody. And with this one-on-one going to confession and confessing your sins, then there began to be, you know, more moderate penances. The penitent would explain the extenuating circumstances, and you know, the Anam Cara would realize, okay, well, that's not what it would be in other circumstance. And then Finian, in his penitential, put in a really stunning innovation. He said, sins are to be absolved in secret by penance and by very diligent devotion. So secret confession goes back to the, you know, Syrian and the Council of Jerusalem, which goes back to the 3rd century. But, again, it's not surprising that the Irish monks would adopt the spiritual practices of the Eastern monks, but it also is not surprising that it would have gotten lost in the rest of Europe. I mean, this is what's so beautiful about the ancient Irish Church, is that it was like a time capsule, and it captured the earliest traditions of the Church and preserved them and let them grow organically. And so that became the Columbanus, then, one of the great saints, the three great saints of Ireland. He then became the missionary who traveled throughout Europe, Germany, Switzerland, and so forth, and re-evangelized that area in a later century. And he took with him the private penance and they called it tariffed penance, meaning let the punishment fit the crime, you know, that the penitent's heart was to be considered and would mitigate the guilt. And he took that to Europe. And then, of course, Charlemagne kind of liked it, and so he picked it up, and so it got all over Europe. But it began in Ireland. Yeah. It began in Ireland.
Yeah, as you're explaining this, Connie, I remember years ago I read a book called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
And oh, yes.
You know, and it basically talked about how the monks had written and made copies of all the great literature from mainland Europe and when continental Europe and when Europe was sacked, that the Irish were able to come back and re-evangelize and re-civilize, I guess you could say, continental Europe. But the more we talk here, and I should say the more you talk here, the more we realize that it wasn't just civilization, but the church itself. Looking back to this stuff now, I think could have an impact on our church today.
Well, it does give us it does help to have a broad perspective.
Yeah.
And to realize that, different centuries and different cultures, but still the one Christ in the Eucharist. And that we're part of a larger, huger tradition. And I find that very exciting.
Yeah.
That is really and anyhow, and yeah. I give the Irish lots of credit.
because
they maintained their real closeness to the origin, to the origin of the church. They were able to keep that very close.
Yeah.
And alive when the rest of the world couldn't.
Yeah, I think you said you want to expand a little bit on the St. John Cassian and the monasticism, but I just wanted to point out that various sections of the book, there'll be a grayed out area with kind of a short topic. And one of them I was happy to see was the 12 Apostles of Irish Monasticism. And because the last of the apostles that you mentioned was St. Canice. And I was born and baptized Kenneth, and I don't know how my parents got away with it because I don't know that there's actually a St. Kenneth. And so when I went to Ireland back in the 90s, I actually went to a church dedicated to St. Canice and realized that it translates to Kenneth in English. So he's my patron. So I didn't even know he was one of the 12 apostles.
Oh, isn't that great?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Happy discovery.
Yeah. So, but St. John Cassian and monasticism, obviously there was monasticism didn't actually start in Ireland, right? There were forms of it, Anthony of Egypt and the Desert Fathers, but was it, I guess, solidified or?
Well, it was. Here's how the chain goes. The Irish may not like to hear this, but probably the first real Christianity to Ireland came from Britain, which at the time, of course, was not England, it was Britain. But here's how the chain of transmission went. St. John the Evangelist, he was a teacher of St. Polycarp, and St. Polycarp was a mentor of St. Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus was a Greek who came from Turkey, but he had gone into Gaul, that is to say, ancient France, and he became the Bishop of Lyon in 177. Now, St. John Cassian, the founder of monasticism, came to a monastery that Honoratus had founded. Now, Honoratus, off the coast of Marseille, there's a little island called Arran, and that monastery became what was historians call the nursery for bishops in the first half of the 5th century, because it followed the Pacomian rule, and Cassian visited it and approved of it, and he dedicated some of his writings to Honoratus, the Gaul, who knew Anthony and knew the Pacomian rule, Anthony's rule. And so that's, three generations, that's almost living memory for that monastery to be founded. And then that monastery then would have had the liturgy as it was practiced in those days and would have had the traditions of the Eastern Church. And so those from Lorraine, the Christians would have gone into Gaul and evangelized Gaul. And then from there, a short hop over to Britain. There is an old tradition in Britain that a man a certain uncle of this boy Jesus, named Joseph of Arimathea, was a tin trader. And the tin of Cornwall provided tin for all of the Mediterranean. And it's a charming tradition in Britain that when Jesus was a boy, he went with his uncle on one of the trips to Cornwall to pick up some tin. A charming tradition, but it shows that this transportation was constant. The trade was constant between Britain and the Mediterranean. In the year 208, that's 200, in the year 208, that's a long time ago, Tertullian wrote that there were places among the Britons that were unapproached by the Romans, but subdued to Christ. Now, what he meant, we don't know. It could have been remote regions of Wales or Cornwall, or, you know, we don't know. We do know that 1 year after the Edict of Milan, after Constantine made it no longer a capital crime to be a Christian, there was a council held at Arles in Gaul, and three bishops from Britain went to it. So there were three British bishops already in the year 314. There would have been a lot of Britons who were Christians who had been captured and taken to Ireland as slaves. There would have been that. There would have been sailors. There would have been all of those coming from Britain. The Egyptians would have been there earlier, and they would have been more isolated, except they left their mark in art and architecture. The beehive huts that are in groups of seven in some of the most ancient monastic locations in Ireland, like Skellig Michael and like Glendalough. The only other place in the world where those beehive huts can be found is Egypt. That style of architecture. And you know, when the monasteries got around in the 6th century to building the high crosses, now, that you can't think of anything more Irish than a Celtic cross, right?
Right.
But what are the carvings on them? Some of those carvings are St. Anthony and Paul in the desert, Paul the Hermit in the desert. There's a cross in, which one is it? Aheni, I think it is, upon which is carved the picture, a sculpture, of a solitary monk under a palm tree. I mean, so this, and some of the high crosses have carvings of Christ in a posture that, in the artistic context, is the same as that of Osiris, the Egyptian high god, where his arms are crossed across his chest and he's holding things in his hands. In Osiris, he's holding a whip, I think, in one hand, and I forget what in the other hand. But in a couple of these high crosses, probably about seven or eight of them, if I'm remembering correctly, Christ is shown in the same posture, holding things in his hand. So the art and the architecture also bears witness to Eastern influence, the Egyptian particularly.
Yeah, I think I had read that one of the carvings in one of the high crosses in Ireland was identical to one that was found in Armenia. Is that right?
Well, that the art historians consider Armenia to be the source of the idea of the high cross, because after Rome fell, there were no more monuments put up in Western Europe. The first crosses ever put up were in Armenia in the 4th century. And Hilary Richardson, who was an art historian, was the first person who was able to get to Georgia, that's what's now the nation of Georgia, behind the Iron Curtain in 1985, I think it was, on an exchange program with the Soviet Union. And she found the exact same images on the South Cross at Castle Dermot in Kildare as in a basilica at Odzum in Georgia. So she found those connections. And, you know, Christ blessing on one of the crosses in Armenia is identical to the Ruthwell cross in Scotland. So, you know, there's obviously artistic connection. And, you know, the president of the Royal Society of Antiquarians of Ireland said in 1965, there is no valid reason to assume that, you know, this could have happened, except the evidence is there. We don't know how it happened. We can't explain how all these happened, but we know it's there because there is no other plausible explanation. There's no valid explanation other than this.
Yeah.
That the same artists were practicing in the Eastern Mediterranean and even the Western Mediterranean as were practicing in Ireland or teaching the artists in Ireland.
Very good. Again, our guest is Connie Marshner. The book is Monastery and High Cross, The Forgotten Eastern Roots of Irish Christianity, published by Sophia Institute Press, available at Sophia's website as well as locally here in the Philadelphia market or St. Jude Shop. Be sure to check them out before hitting up any of the other retailers. And I have just a couple of minutes left, Connie, and like I said, I was fascinated by the book, and then there's an endorsement on the back from Seamus O'Fennessy, who's the historian at the Donegal Association of New York. And, you know, high ratings. This is the best book on the history of true Celtic Christianity I have ever read. With an Ireland that today is so secularized and anglicized, I believe Connie Marshner's Monastery and High Cross holds the key to an authentically Catholic revitalization of the church in Ireland, Scotland, and anywhere on earth the descendants of the Gaelic people live today. That's pretty high regards, Connie.
No, it is. God love Seamus O'Fennessy.
Yeah.
But you know, I know we just have a couple seconds left, but you mentioned the Saints and Scholars Foundation at the beginning, and that is a group that I founded in order to help restore Catholic education in Ireland, because there is a movement afoot in Ireland that is to establish independent, private, faithful Catholic schools run by lay people. We've had them in this country for 40 years, but they never existed in Ireland before. And now there is one in County Cork, in the town of Cork, called Mater Dei Academy, and that's a school that we're helping. It's great promise, very faithful, a beautiful school. So if you're interested in helping restore the faith in Ireland by building a new model of independent Catholic education, without government, without religious orders, without the church, but nonetheless faithful Catholic tradition, check out the Saints and Scholars website.
Yeah, that's saintsandscholars.us if you're looking it up. Anything else, Connie, before we have to let you go?
Get the book. You'll be glad you did.
No.
It's a good read.
Yeah.
It'll keep you up at night reading it.
Yeah, I got a vacation coming and it's going with me. So
thank you.
Thank you for that. Now, and I mean, especially if you're of Irish descent and sometimes the Irish get you know, we're given a hard time, and we didn't have it easy in this country in the beginning. And to see the important role that Ireland's played, you know, not only in saving civilization but potentially saving the church, is pretty cool. So I encourage folks like Connie to go out and pick up this book. Connie, it was great to be with you. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for spending the whole hour.
Oh, the pleasure was mine. Thank you for having me.
All right. You take care and God bless you now.
You too.
Bye-bye. I have to admit, you know, once in a while, when I don't have a chance to get through the whole book, you know, there's so much information on the Internet. I happened to watch part of a an interview that, that Connie had done with somebody else, and just the energy she has for this topic, and the, you know, the combination of being interested in the Irish language, the Gaelic, and diving into the history of our church in Ireland. There's a lot that, that she reveals in the book that I don't think anybody was aware of, herself included, until she started to dive into this. On another note, coming up this Sunday is Father's Day, and it's a great day for we fathers who are still connected with our families and our kids, and the circles that, you know, I travel in and my friends in recovery travel in, it's not that way for a lot of fathers that are out there. A bunch of them have made mistakes and may have been not only end up being divorced, but sometimes they're deprived of seeing their kids, or their children have been moved to another state. And again, it's all part of the legal system and everything else. But, you know, for a lot of fathers, it's a great day. I'll be blessed on Sunday to have all four of my kids over at the house. But there's a lot of fathers that won't have that. And so for the dads that that will be with their families, you know, enjoy every minute that you have to spend with them. And I just ask your prayers for all those fathers that are separated from their kids for whatever reason, whether it was their own doing or something that may have been done to them that's landed them in that situation. I just ask you to pray for them and their children, that at some point God sees fit to have them reunited, as long as it, you know, is God's will, and that they should be reunited. And I just mentioned that because as Father was given the blessing at the end of Saints and Sinners, you know, it just came to mind. I had a couple of men's faces flash in front of me who, you know, struggle in that area where they're not able to see their kids, or even, you know, they see their kids, but the kids really have a tough time relating to them. They may have been hurt or upset by what Dad may have done, and still aren't ready to completely forgive what had happened. So keep us all in prayer, all the dads, this coming Father's Day, and a happy Father's Day to all of you. I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.